The court gets arguments it's been waiting for, but will they make a difference in the fight over extreme injustice? In a closely divided North Carolina, America's ninth largest state, politics has taken a dangerous turn, moving from the campaign trail to the court bench. Little known to the public, four state Supreme Court justices are considering a legal maneuver that threatens the credibility and viability of the state's highest court for decades to come. Two constitutional amendments, 9.6 million votes, and the fate of two duly elected Supreme Court justices hang in the balance. The Wall Street Journal calls it scorched earth judging, writing that if successful, this institutional mischief will reverberate far beyond North Carolina. How did we get here? And where are we going? And will raw partisan politics alter the courts for generations, throwing our constitutional order into chaos? Reported by the Carolina Journal and produced by the John Locke Foundation, I am your host, Dallas Woodhouse, and this is Extreme Injustice. Welcome back to Extreme Injustice. I'm investigative political analyst Dallas Woodhouse with Carolina Journal, a project of the John Locke Foundation. Joining me again as my adult supervision, the senior political analyst for the John Locke Foundation, Mitch Kokai, and the president and general counsel of the North Carolina Institute of Constitutional Law, a proud Auburn graduate, Jeanette Doran. Now, when Carolina Journal first broke this story, back a number of months ago, a lot of people were suspicious that they didn't believe that there was really an effort to remove these justices to maybe gain a political advantage to get the amendments off. Our story was confirmed when the Supreme Court of North Carolina put out an order asking for arguments from both the NAACP's lawyers, which of course are suing to not only remove the amendments on voter ID and lowering the maximum income tax that were passed in 2018, but are also pushing to remove Justices Phil Berger and Tamara Berenger. They wanted arguments from them, and they wanted arguments from the legislative defendants. And it's just kind of an interesting situation that these two are putting arguments in front of the court to settle an internal dispute about forced recusal. Now, but those arguments came in, and we're here to talk about those today. And I want to read this to start us off. This is from the legislative defendants. An involuntary recusal in the teeth of a justice's own judgment, that recusal is not necessary, is in effect a public declaration that the justice has engaged in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. It is difficult to imagine a procedure better calculated to poison the deliberations of this body and its ability to fulfill its constitutionally assigned role in a professional and effective manner. Those are the attorneys representing the legislative leaders in the NAACP versus Moore case. And what they are, I love this term, in the teeth. In other words, you know, doing this to a justice who doesn't believe they ought to be recused, you know, puts the court in real danger. And it's difficult to imagine a procedure better calculated to poison the deliberations of this body and fulfill its constitutionally assigned role. What did you think about that, Jeanette?
I thought it was well put and brings into the discussion, the conversation, like, what is the court going, how is the court really going to be able to function going forward if it ends up with this kind of balkanization where we've got some judges telling other justices, you're not allowed to participate? You know, it almost would turn it into kind of a we pick our own fraternity style court. And I think what the legislative defendants have pointed out, and rightly so, is that once we have justices bullying other justices by forcing them out of participation in a case, they're not going to have the same kind of collegial dynamic that they have historically enjoyed.
Yeah, because case after case, they could be deciding, hey, I don't want you on this case, so I'm going to vote you off.
Yes.
And I, this is a good opportunity, Dallas. You and I have spent most of the episodes talking about these issues. It's great to have Jeanette's legal expertise because we can ask her some of the questions that only a lawyer, and specifically only a lawyer who follows this stuff, would know. One of the interesting things I noticed about the briefing on this is we often see one side in the case puts forward an argument, then the other side responds, and then the other side responds. In this case, the lawyers on both sides were ordered to turn in their documents at the same time, so they couldn't see what the other one was writing. What did you make of how the documents turned out based on the fact that they couldn't respond to each other?
I was not very surprised by either the structure or content of the briefs. So the court ordered simultaneous briefing, but mostly what we saw from the plaintiff's brief is that it pretty much mirrored what had been in their motion, but it was just fleshed out a little more. The legislative defendants had, prior to the briefing order, they had opposed the motion, and their ultimate briefing on it was, again, pretty much a mirror of what they had previously filed, but fleshed out a little more. So I wasn't surprised by the content of the brief by either party on the initial briefs. I thought the reply briefs, because both sides, they filed their opening briefs simultaneously, and then they had an opportunity a couple weeks later to file their responses to the other side. There were a few opportunities there that I think maybe I was a little surprised not to have seen some of the arguments of amici addressed more fully. This is a case that has had an unusually high number of friend of the court briefs, not just...
And that's what she means when she says amici.
Yes, yes. It's an amicus brief, and the plural would be amici. So you had lots
kind
of amici.
Kind of a fancy word when everybody's sticking their nose in and giving an opinion.
So there were a few issues raised by some of the friend of the court briefs that I was a little surprised we didn't see more specifically addressed, but that I think the court will be well served by really the bounty of all the briefs we've seen.
I think it's important to note here that the attorneys for the legislative defendants not only say that the court should not do this, they say the court can't do that. Quoting from the brief, Canon 3 of the North Carolina Code of Judicial Conduct, the only state law governing recusal of members of this court expressly provides that the decision whether recusal is necessary or appropriate is up to the justices themselves. Quote, a justice's individual determination whether to recuse is necessarily final, simply by virtue of the court's position at the top of the judicial system, wrote Martin Worf for the legislative defendants. Worf goes on to say this hardly makes the state of North Carolina an outlier. This approach is the practice of the federal judiciary, where the recusal determinations of justices of the U.S. Supreme Court are also individual, final, and non-reviewable. It's also in accord with the approach adopted by nearly two-thirds of the states.
Well, and the very definition of recusal, if you go to Black's Law Dictionary, which is the sort of the Mac daddy of all legal dictionaries, and you look up the definition of recusal, it speaks of removing oneself. And when we look at...
Yeah, that's why most of the time we've used the term forced removal, because you can't involuntarily recuse somebody. You can, put a proverbial gun to their head and make them go away, but...
And even our code, we have something called the Code of Judicial Conduct, and we have Judicial Standards Commission, and they're really, those are the ethical rules by which judges and justices are to conduct themselves, and we have the Judicial Standards Commission to investigate, alleged violations. But all of that code speaks of recusal as a decision made by the judge or justice. And when we look at potential discipline for any violation of the Code of Judicial Conduct, it's an after the fact, right? So judges aren't kicked off a case before there's an alleged ethical violation. It's after the fact, if there was really an ethical violation, then there's discipline that comes down. Judicial standards refers it up to the court. There's a very detailed process for it. But that's all an after the fact. The recusal is entirely up to the judge or justice in question. And that's very clear, not just in North Carolina, but as Dallas, as you pointed out, in the federal judiciary and in the overwhelming majority of state judiciaries.
Mitch, the brief goes on to say, even if the power to force an individual justice off a case were lawful policy, it would not be a prudent one. As the Chief Justice of the United States explained in 2011, allowing involuntary recusal would, quote, create an undesirable situation in which the court could affect the outcome of a case by selecting who among its members may participate.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And even more so, as we alluded to, I think, in the last episode in speaking with Jeanette, this is very true when you're talking about a court like North Carolina's Supreme Court, where the members are elected. People throughout the state elected people to serve in this role if they are involuntarily recused, or as Dallas mentioned, what's better to say, forcibly removed from the case. You are telling the voters your vote didn't matter in this case.
Wrapping up the conversation about the legislative defendant's argument, I thought this part was really telling. Quote, it is no answer to suggest that involuntary recusal would be a rare occurrence reserved for the most extraordinary occasions. A procedure such as this would tend to quickly extend to the outer limits of its logic. Fundamental institutional dynamics would make this inevitable. For instance, could a justice's impartiality reasonably be questioned because the justice is a member of a nonprofit advocacy group, which is a party to the proceeding before the court? What if a party believes that a justice will, instead of being impartial, simply vote along a political party line? Is that impartiality a valid basis for seeking the recusal of Democrats or Republicans? While forcing a justice's involuntary recusal may seem today an extraordinary step, the first use of such a power will transform the way it is viewed, leading familiarity to a raw exercise of power that had previously been unthinkable, and create a natural desire for retribution for the part of those justices who opposed the act. Jeanette?
I think that about says it all, doesn't it? Once this sort of power is exercised for the first time, and that's what we would be talking about, were the court to grant the motion, there's really no telling how it will snowball in the years to come.
And certainly, you've already alluded to it, Dallas, there have been other attempts, and we will see more, to have Justice Berger removed because his father is the named defendant in other cases. Anything challenging a law is going to name Phil Berger Sr., and so that would be an opportunity for someone to try to remove Phil Berger Jr.
So Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm going to cut you off there, Dallas. Also, keep in mind, Justice Berger was in the legislature, so anybody who has a bone to pick with the statutes as they are can complain that she shouldn't be allowed to participate in the case because she was in the legislature and voted for something, or maybe it's a law that's been on the books for 50 years, and somebody can come in and say, you know what, when she was at the legislature, she should have done something to repeal this law, and she didn't, so that's a sign there's really no way, and these sound like, sort of a crazy example, but there's really no way to see an end once this gets going, which is why it's so important that the courts stand firm and deny the motion to disqualify.
And one of the arguments that was actually brought up in one of the federal circuits, I want to say it was the 7th or the 6th, I might be wrong, a number of years ago, about involuntary recusals, was, I think it raised a great question of, you know, if you allowed this kind of thing, would you have very qualified people that are in the legislature no longer desire to serve the judiciary because they think they couldn't serve? And that would, you know, further limit North Carolinians' choices. So what does the NAACP say? What is their reason they presented in front of the court for removing these justices? Something that's very political, and they blame politics. That's coming up on Extreme Injustice.
Extreme Injustice, an investigative project of Carolina Journal, is produced by the John Locke Foundation. For three decades, Locke has served as an independent, nonprofit think tank that works for truth, freedom, and the future of North Carolina. Locke envisions a strong North Carolina committed to individual freedom, personal responsibility, and limited constitutional government. To support our work, please visit johnlocke.org. Carolina Journal is your source for news and commentary covering politics and public policy. As a project of the John Locke Foundation, Carolina Journal is a pioneer in nonprofit investigative journalism. Our work has exposed corruption, conflicts of interest, and misuse of taxpayer funds by public officials, including members of Congress and the state legislature. Now, our attention is squarely focused on the North Carolina Supreme Court with our in-depth investigative series, Extreme Injustice. Visit carolinajournal.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Extreme Injustice. I'm Dallas Woodhouse. Now, when the NAACP sought to formally remove two Supreme Court justices from the critical amendments case, they also presented detailed arguments to the Supreme Court. Here's one thing they had to say. The NAACP wrote, "The absence of a clear, transparent, and consistent process to govern recusal in North Carolina for the Supreme Court undermines constitutional order. Litigants have a constitutional right to a fair tribunal, yet our highest appellate court currently has no system to ensure that that right is guaranteed," wrote the attorneys, as they seek to remove Justice Phil Berger Jr. and Tamara Berenger. But here's the part, and I wrote in the article that this part is just like dripping with irony everywhere. We all know removing these justices is political, and as political as hell.
You can find these articles, by the way, at extremeinjustice.com. This one, it has the headline, "State Supreme Court Accepts Arguments Concerning Forced Removal of Its Own Justices," authored by Dallas.
That's right. In a paragraph just dripping with irony, the NAACP attorneys blame the increased partisan nature and expense of judicial campaigns for the urgent need for the court to take the most partisan action in the history of the court. If the Supreme Court grants the NAACP's wish, those two justices would be removed. And they blame politics. And I quote, the recent legislature-initiated changes politicizing judicial elections, along with the surge in the amount of money pouring into North Carolina's judicial races, has increased the possibilities for conflicts of interest and potential questions of bias, as well as increasing the danger of erosion of public confidence in the independence of the judiciary. These changes, independent and in concert with the necessity for clarity and procedures of due process, argue in favor of adoption of rules setting procedures for judicial recusal. Now, let me tell you why this is ridiculous. Okay? Now, they're talking about a couple things here. Y'all know for gazillion years, we elected judges on a partisan basis. That meant they had R's and D's and L's for libertarian and unaffiliated by their name. In the early 2000s, the Democrats took those off. Now, they also tried to force taxpayers to fund judicial campaigns. This was another blatant partisan move. And all that crap you hear from Democrats talking about disenfranchising people, and if we have voter ID, we're going to disenfranchise people. You know, for over a decade, there was no bigger disenfranchisement of voters in North Carolina, because when we took the party labels off, we had, you know, Jeanette earlier talked about drop off. You know, we had the drop off, you know, from 2 or 3 or 4% in judicial races. And then when we didn't have party labels on there, it went up to 30%. So Republicans put those judicial races back on. Look, Democrats took the party labels off because it was good for them. Republicans put them back on because it was good for them. At the same time, when Republicans put them back on, it caused, you know, a lot more people to vote, because it may not be the best reason to vote for somebody due to how they're registered to vote, you know, whether they're a Republican or Democrat, but it's at least some information. This notion, you know, I would say this, the court shouldn't be that important, and then the campaigns won't cost so much. You know, the court shouldn't be considering throwing off other judges and throwing off damn duly elected, duly passed constitutional amendments. This argument just makes me mad, to be honest about it, Mitch. This idea that it's the politics that causes the NAACP to try to attempt something that is the most partisan political move in the history of North Carolina's judiciary.
I like the way that you wrote this, saying that it was a paragraph dripping with irony that the NAACP was making this argument. And
that's because they wouldn't print what I really want to say. We don't use them words on CarolinaJournal.com.
But one of the interesting things to me about this is that you're looking at some changes in the way that we elect justices and judges that give more information to the voters, putting the party labels back on, having no limits on your ability to speak, meaning these limits on how much you could spend because you're taking the public financing. All of these things are better for the electoral process, but these are things that the NAACP are saying have made the judiciary more politicized, as if there wasn't a situation when we had the no party labels that the parties still chose their own candidates. There was still always a Democrat running against a Republican, but you had to take an extra step to find out who they were because the R's and the D's weren't on the ballot.
Well, and I can tell you this, from somebody who used to be a party official and we were going around recruiting judicial candidates, the most important thing wasn't somebody's qualifications, it was their name. You know, I don't know whether we would have elected Mark Martin as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court if he didn't have a name that was the exact same as a popular NASCAR driver, even though he was a great justice. I mean, that was not a way to handle a judiciary. Now, Jeanette, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but explain here why the NAACP is full of it when they talk about, you know, that we've gotten more partisan, so we need to throw judges off so we can get the partisan outcome we want.
It's a ridiculous argument, ridiculous to the absurd. Look, let's face it. Judgeships are going to be political in nature. Here in North Carolina, there's a certain amount of politicking that goes on because we elect our judges. But even if you look at a model like the federal system has, where judges are appointed for life, well, they're all nominated by the President of the United States and confirmed by the United States Senate. I mean, that takes politics. It's not like the President just puts a job posting up on LinkedIn and says, hey, if you'd like to be on the Supreme Court, apply here. So we're always going to have a certain amount of politics involved. And anytime there are politics involved, there will be some measure of it that's going to be partisan. What I think we're seeing now is the natural consequence of these politically motivated lawsuits that aren't really about what the law is. They're really about left-wing activists unhappy with the decision of voters, whether it's on the referendum or on the election of justices. These left-wing activists are going to the court with a game plan that if they can't win at the ballot box, they're going to win at the court.
Yeah, this is something that Extreme Injustice has already mentioned, but it bears repeating. Whatever you think about the process that these constitutional amendments took to get on the ballot, ultimately, the voters of North Carolina approved them. So even if it was the worst General Assembly possible and everything that went into putting that General Assembly into office was terrible, and no one's conceding outside of the left-wing activists that that is true. But even if that were true, the voters could have said, no, this is a bad idea. But the voters overwhelmingly said yes to voter ID and the tax cap amendment. And that's the ultimate authority, the will of the people. And now, as you said, the people who don't like what the people said are trying to get the courts to say, no, voters of North Carolina, you can't have what you want.
Coming up on our next episode of Extreme Injustice could be what's good for the goose, maybe good for the gander. We'll see on the next Extreme Injustice. Extreme Injustice is an investigative project of the Carolina Journal and produced by the John Locke Foundation. It is written and hosted by me, Dallas Woodhouse, with adult supervision from our senior political analyst, Mitch Kokai. Creative design by Greg Dedug, with communication support from Brooke Medidum. Donna King is the editor-in-chief of the Carolina Journal. Donald Bryson is the president of the John Locke Foundation, and Amy Cook is the publisher and CEO. For this story's latest development, please visit carolinajournal.com and extremeinjustice.com. Follow us on Twitter at Carolina Journal. To support this and other work of the John Locke Foundation, please visit johnlocke.org as we continue to expose extreme injustice.